Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books and Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Our guest for the episode is Claudia Heilbrunn. Claudia is a licensed psychoanalyst in private practice in New York City. She received her BA from Columbia University, her MA from the University of Pennsylvania, and her analytic training from the Institute of Psychoanalytic Training and Research. Claudia is also the owner of Claudia Inc. Tutoring, a company devoted to helping students of all aptitudes improve their writing and reading comprehension skills. She joins us today to talk about her book, What Happens When the Analyst Dies, Unexpected Terminations in Psychoanalysis, published 2020 by Routledge. Claudia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much for having me today.
I've wanted to have you since the book came out. I think it's a very, very important topic. What motivated you to write the book?
You know, there were so many motivations. The primary motivation happened well over a decade before I actually wrote the book or put together the book, since there's so many contributors to it. I was in a long-term psychoanalytic treatment, and my analyst got sick and died. And she was actually my second analyst to die. The first one, that happened in about 1992. I was in my 20s, and it was a pretty traumatizing death because I didn't know he was ill, and and I was in a stage of development where it was really catastrophic for me. And then the second analyst died, and I was left again in this, you know, what I call this world of kind of complete isolation and, dead analyst mode, where nobody knew the person who had died. Nobody that I knew, because I wasn't in training, I wasn't in the field, I was just a patient. So nobody I knew was in analysis. They had no idea what this person, whom I loved so much, I had seen her for 12 years, four times a week, was very dependent on. Nobody could understand just how grief-stricken I was. And so at that time, I really worked to find anything I could read about it. And, you know, I didn't have access to something like PepWeb, so I couldn't find anything. There were no articles that I could locate. And I thought, I can't be the only one. I mean, other people have therapists who die. And so I decided to put together a book, and I didn't have access to people in the field, of course. So I put advertisements on Craigslist, looking for anybody who, you know, could write about the topic, and I got no responses, and I just put it to rest. And then a few years later, I decided to pursue analytic training at IPTAR. And 6 years into my training, my training analyst died. So that was my third analyst to die while I was in treatment. And I was in a very different place, but I still could recognize as a candidate, Ali Zand, you know, how much really goes wrong when analysts get ill and die. And so I decided at that point to move forward with the project I'd put to rest all those years ago. And it was easier because I had more access to people and just resources. And so it really was spurred out of my own experience. And then, of course, you know, I had a real mission at that point, which was I thought that the analytic community really wasn't paying attention to the issue enough, that it, you know, people died and there was kind of horror at what may have happened, but then it went underground again. And I hoped that putting together a book in which patients' voices were highlighted, that the analytic community would really be equipped with real knowledge of what patients experience, how truly catastrophic and excruciating it is for patients, especially those, you know, at a particular stages of development or psychic, you know, having particular psychic health. So that when the community and when analysts themselves really heard the voices of patients, that they would take action and do more and, you know, take it more seriously. And also so that institutes would do more to safeguard not only the patients, but also the analysts who are clearly struggling with their own illness and death. And, you know, hopefully change training to include more on the subject so people could be better prepared to deal with it. So I guess those were my two reasons.
And have you seen that at an institute? Has there been, I think the term is the Psychoanalyst Assistance Committee. Has anything happened either at your institute or others?
You know, IPTAR had it, and the last chapter in the book, Nancy Einbinder talks about her putting together that group at IPTAR, but it was really underutilized. I actually don't know if it's used more. I know that, and I don't know many institutes. I know IPTAR, that the clinic at IPTAR now requires things like analytic wills. So I think those are becoming more common, where if you're a candidate working at the clinic, you need to have an analytic will. You need to designate someone to be the person who, you know, helps your patients if you should die. So I thought that was a, you know, that's a basic step in the right direction. I wish I could say more. I actually don't know what other institutes are doing. COVID happened shortly afterwards and everything kind of shifts after the book came out. So I don't know that this was primary. Even interestingly enough, death has been so big in our culture. So I don't know if this is what they've been dealing with since there've been so many other big things happening lately.
Yeah. You mentioned you had your two analysts and your training analysts, three analysts die. The subtitle of the book is Unexpected Terminations in Psychoanalysis. You said the first analyst was unexpected. Were the other two planned and or expected? Were all three unexpected?
They were all different. I mean, my first analyst was in complete denial. I don't think he thought he was going to die on his deathbed. I mean, he was a character unto himself. So I think he was in a different category of analyst because his denial was so deep. It was the AIDS epidemic. He really thought AIDS was something that wouldn't kill him, that was psychological. So there's a lot in that. My second analyst got sick 6 years into my treatment. She had breast cancer and also I think had a kidney removed. And then, not a kidney, a liver. Wait, I can't remember now. And then she got ill again, I guess, in the last year of my treatment. But again, she knew about her illness, but didn't plan on closing her practice, didn't take steps to tell her patient. She told me, because I made her promise to tell me if she got sick when I began the analysis, but she didn't tell any of her other patients until the last week that she was working. And I only know that because by the end of that treatment, she was telling me a lot. So the treatment had changed. And then my third analyst, I noticed that he was sick. He got a diagnosis that was incorrect from his doctors. And he was in treatment for lung cancer. But again, I think he really thought he could beat it. He never closed his practice either. There were a lot of canceled sessions at the end. And then we were supposed to come back after the summer break, and he canceled, and then he said tomorrow, and then he canceled. And then in the end, I said goodbye on the phone because he just wasn't well enough. I think that, especially with modern medicine, there's so many hopeful miracle cures to things like cancer that people don't give up hope of beating it. And so you're faced with analyst's own denial and the, slim chance that maybe someone will. So, And my first two analysts, nobody told me that they died. So my first one just was, I think, irresponsible. He didn't do anything. The second one, I think things must have fallen, through the cracks that I wasn't called. It just so happened that I met someone who knew her, who on the day of her funeral, and didn't know why I wasn't at the funeral. And so I rushed to the funeral so I could go to that. And then the third analyst, I was part of the community. So he handled it very well, got a phone call and went to the memorial. But I don't think any of them were planned or nothing was, there was no termination process or anything.
Yeah, I'm someone who's lost two analysts, and the funeral thing is very interesting because when the first one died, he was in denial, deep denial. And so was I as a patient. That's where I was in the, full transference neuroses, and that I learned he had died when someone called me, another patient who somehow, I don't know how she found out. I guess she called for a session because he died in between sessions for me. So I wouldn't have known. And what I was aware of, she called me, she said, Jim, they had the funeral today. And one of the things I was like, oh, I wasn't invited to the funeral. I wasn't. And it was that thing with, oh shit, I'm not family. I mean, it was a deep, not a narcissistic wound, but that real wake up call. And I'm going to use the word just, because I know that's not right. Oh, wait, I'm just a patient. I'm not family.
I'm so sorry you lost two analysts. It's really hard. But I think that was a theme throughout the book, with the different contributors, how even if they went to the funeral and were, quote, invited, that it's so evident that you're alone, you are not the family, you can't really participate in any mourning rituals, there's no one to share your loss, to laugh or cry with. It's a completely private grief process, which makes it in some ways more challenging to hold on to the person because you have to do it by yourself, which isn't typically how we grieve loved ones.
Well, but that's right. And I think that that's also the other thing I experienced is that the absolute isolation, because if you're not in an analytic community, if you say in the world, my father died, my mother died, everybody in a sense knows what that means. It's time off from work. People sort of, you can share that widely, and now you can put it on Facebook. I mean, it's sort of globally understood what these deaths are. How do you, my therapist died, unless someone knows that experience, it's so isolating. It's very, Yeah. And so this goes to, I think you told me why you wrote this as a book and not a paper. You want, if a patient who's not in the community loses a therapist, to be able to find your book.
Yeah, because I couldn't find any material when my analyst, my first or second analyst died. And, you know, today, if I weren't in the community, it's easier just because of there's more access now than there was then. But a book, it will come up it will come up no matter what. And I've tried to make it a name that if you Googled just a few good words, you would find it.
It's a SEO optimized title.
And it's part of the reason, you know, the patient stories are highlighted in it, because, you know, what you see when you read it is that people, no matter how different the patients are, no matter how different the analysts are, no matter where the person is, everybody really experiences this, you know, similar kind of themes. If their analyst dies, the isolation being, you know, a primary one, feeling invisible, an invisible mourner, where nobody else can vaguely understand why you're so upset. When my first analyst died, you know, he was the most, and a part of it was, I mean, truly how to, unable to put into any other words how screwed up I was at that point. I was young and I was a mess. And he was everything to me, everything. So his death was like, I was shattered, you know, and there was nobody who could understand, you know, what on earth, why I would be having such an issue because my therapist died.
The only person who can understand is the person who died.
Yes.
That's what's so... Because I had the same experience, shattered, blown apart. I refer to myself as an ambulatory psychotic because I was in the world. The person who I would bring this to is dead, and so it's a staggering loss. And it was interesting because I also wanted to believe, in my grandiosity, that I have had the most staggering loss of all. So reading other patients in your book, I'm like, okay, other people have it too.
Well, again,
I will concede.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, two things. One is, you know, you said this when I spoke to you on the phone, like we don't realize how large we loom in patients' worlds. And also when I read Lynn Jacobs' chapter, two of us, you know, and they're only, you know, they're like eight patients here who are doing the memoir pieces. Two out of eight mentioned that our inner landscapes were like Mount St. Helens in the 90s, which, you know, so that's, that for me was really interesting when I saw that she used my metaphor, you know, or she visited it, I visited it. And it was like, that is exactly what this feels like. This just utter death and destruction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's interesting not knowing how large we loom. It's because I think about, so the idea of the analytic will is who's going to contact the patients? Are they invited to the funeral? All these postmortem directives, which I didn't have. And I have that for each of my patients. Who's going to call them? Who they're super, you know, who's supervising the case, so that they that content. And in sense, one of the authors says, you know, or no, you say it, and I think in the epilogue that, you know, we bear responsibility, we bear great responsibility for our patients, and it's responsible and I think ethical to have this will.
Happens to all the files? When my first analyst died, he used to tape record our sessions. Like, what happened to those tapes? I was left haunted by what happened to those tapes. I mean, I'm sure they were thrown away. When my second analyst died, she was supposed to mail me back all of my poetry and creative writing that I had given her through the years, because I used to write a lot. And she must have forgotten because she was so sick. Like, where'd that all go? And, you know, it's a narcissistic thought. There were so many things that were more important. Maybe those are the things we focus on because they're smaller. But I always wonder, like, what happened to it? Was it in a garbage? Like, where's my stuff? How do they handle that? So things like, you know, how do you keep your anonymity when once your analyst is dead? Did her, like, family read it? I don't know.
Right. Well, so it's interesting with patients' voices and getting that material. We had an author on the channel 2 years ago who, she's an analyst, she's in her late 80s, but she wrote a book about being institutionalized in the late 50s and shock therapy and insulin therapy and all this stuff. And to write, and she kept a journal of what it was like for her at the time. And when she went back to write her book, she got the process notes from, I don't know if it was Bronx Psychiatric, wherever she was. She got her own process notes to read what she was going through and what the analysts were writing.
That's so interesting. So you could see them side by side, and they're probably very different.
They're so different. But here's what's interesting with that is that, so she's published, she's an analyst, she's working, you can read her book. And it's about her, you know, trauma and suicide attempt and what she went through. It's a full disclosure of her. And so her patients can read this, and it strengthens the work that they know something, because in your book, you're reviewing the literature on disclosure. And what do you tell your patients? And there was a number of authors who said, you tell them nothing. And one author, I forget who it was, the paper was 1982. I always sort of place things on when things are written, because I think that's where the theory goes. That to disclose serves only the analyst's narcissistic needs to confess and should be withheld.
Yes, yes. I think Nancy Einbinder quoted that when she was talking about, you know, through the years, she was trying to grapple with this at IPTAR, the different thoughts on beliefs on it. But they still are keeping it a secret. And that, you know, I think more and more analysts are being more transparent. But I also think that an analyst can only be as transparent as his, her, or their psyche allows. And that's kind of the kicker. You know, the kicker about being an analyst, you can only do as much as your own psyche allows. And when you're facing your own trauma, your own death, you know, how well you're going to deal with it with your patients will depend on how much you can grapple with it within yourself. They can't be separated. And I don't think we can trust the analysts alone to be able to do it, because we're all human. Like, we all will be stopped by our own need for denial or for, you know, I Therese Rosen says it, that, you know, she was full of fear and she couldn't deal with her patient's fear because she was too afraid herself. And, you know, I love that about her essay. She's so honest. And I don't think it necessarily, she was ill. She isn't someone who, thank goodness, died. But her experience really shows what someone who's petrified, facing something that could be life-threatening, deals with within themselves and then has to take into the analytic room, and how they can function trying to cope with both their own feelings and their patients.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the psychoanalyst assistance committee, is assistance for the analyst who is sick. I mean, it's a supervision, it's a specific way of talking. And what's great about her chapter is she's writes about it from being a sick analyst, but also being an analysand with a dying. I mean, her chapter does both.
Both.
It's really, really, really good. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about developmentally where you were in the first treatment and young, and I think it, and we see this, that where people are developmentally. I have a friend who the fantasy, she, now this is going back 30 years ago, found a therapist who was perfect for her. She's finally, you know, she found the someone who's going to, and he died maybe a month into treatment. And so that fantasy analysis, no one has ever been able to satisfy. That's the perfect analyst, and he died. Mm-hmm. So developmentally, was very, very early on, and I think about, and she's convinced that that was her one shot at treatment. That was it, and it's over. It'll never happen again. I think about Adam Phillips, who writes in Missing Out that we become experts on the life we don't have as opposed to the one we do have. Mm-hmm. In some of the chapters write about the, well, so let's start with how we, can we know how large we loom? Like I think about, okay, which cases do I think, all right, this is going to be, you know, devastating, shattering, really super challenging. Some cases, which I think, oh, it'll be sad. I think that they'll be, you know, in a sense, okay. But I'm wondering, can we know?
You know, I think, again, it, you know, I have a patient and I remember being a little surprised by how much suddenly she seemed to, you know, be attached to me. Like I was like, oh, really? I had no idea. Just in one session, I kind of woke up to it. So then, of course, I had to look at what was going on in me that was preventing me from, you know, feeling that, knowing that, because, and then, you know, deal with that. I think we should be able to, you know, I think we should be able to know who our patients are and where they are. I think that, you know, the patients who really experienced the deaths is catastrophic. I think it depended on a couple things. One was, you know, how the analyst dealt with it. You know, there are two chapters where the analyst dealt with it pretty well, and those two people fared pretty well. But they also, I don't think either of them had severe early attachment issues. I know with my first analyst, I had no semblance of a separate self. I mean, he was so in me. I was not, you know, so when he went, you know, I was blown to smithereens too, because, you know, there was no separation. You see it in, you know, one author, Lynn Jacobs, who is the dual chapter, you know, felt like she was shattered because she felt like, what did she say? It was like she was like an infant the metaphors they use, like she felt like a fish stuck in the shallows, like trying to hold on to life and plopping around. You know, one other patient talked about, you know, finally finding a mother who could nurse her, only for the mother to die while holding her in her arms. So all of these speak to really early attachment issues where the patients haven't yet, you know, felt separate, and their, you know, what they've gained in treatment hasn't gelled. And so, you know, when the analyst dies, the parts of them that came to life or that they were bringing to life within the analytic room die too, because they haven't secured it yet. And I think that's when, I think as analysts, we should know who those patients are. That doesn't seem like a mystery to me, but maybe I'm deceiving myself.
Well, I think, yes, I think we should know. I think, of course, we should know. I think my question is, I think my question comes out of Andre Green, who says we are in a constant dialogue with the unknown. So I think we should know, and I think I allow room to say I don't know, and well, proceed with caution.
100%. I don't mean no in a kind of arrogant way. I mean, what we see more than anything is that whatever an analyst thinks he, she, or they are doing, you never know the impact on the patient until you hear the patient's voice, you know? So I think, of course, I mean, yeah, I mean, yes, 100%. I don't think we ever really know, because we are not that person. And we can think, I mean, like mine, I didn't realize how attached a patient was. And I learned, but I don't think we as analysts will ever know truly how our deaths will impact patients, which is why we have to create a safety net for them so that other people can help them through it, because we're not going to be there and we don't know.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, I was thinking about that. There's a theory somewhere I've picked up. I don't know where it comes from, that you have the analysis, and then you have, once it's over, the analysis of the analysis, where you try to look at what happened. And I'm wondering if, and this was, and I'm asking a question that my answer is yes. Is the death of the analyst, in a sense, the final intervention that the analyst makes? Because for me, it revealed the transference neuroses. It revealed the fantasy relationship. It revealed my own denial of what was going on. He was physically very, very weak, and I didn't see it. I mean, I looked right at him a week before, and I didn't see it. I can see it now. It was a group conference, so there's photographs from that. So if I look at the picture, I'm like, oh my God, emaciated. I didn't see it. I didn't see it. For me, it was, in a sense, necessary to complete the analysis.
You mean it was necessary for you to process the analysis with yourself or with another person in order to complete it?
It was necessary for the term, which I'm trying to think of something better, but it was, in a sense, a maturational intervention. It was the intervention, analysis terminable and interminable. It was, as horrible as it is, it was, in a sense, something I needed.
You mean you needed the death, or you needed to process it, and that's what taught you so much about it?
I needed the death.
And that's interesting. I've actually never...
I might have stayed where I was developmentally forever. In fact, this I think turned to his way of working. He was very much interested in insulation, the insulation barrier, and he really worked that way. And so now I was in training at this point, so I have a whole community. And so when we had a group get together to talk about him, we all had the exact same emotional experience. Was, oh my God, I didn't realize I'd aged. So I started analysis when I was 26. He passed when I was 43. I still felt 26 because
he
insulated at that time. But all of his analysands had the same thing, that they hadn't aged.
Well, see, I think that speaks to, and I don't know your analyst or anything, but it speaks to how a particular analyst's approach and maybe, ways of treatment that aren't necessarily in patients' best interest. And again, I don't know your analyst, how patients will do their analyst bidding, and how, then there's just kind of an ongoing, for lack of a better word, enactment going on. Like my first analyst death, I mean, to be frank, it was the most catastrophic for me, but it was the best thing that happened to me because he was really, an analyst shouldn't use this word, but I'll just say he was destructive, and it was a really sick analysis. And it was like being in a cult. And if he didn't die, I don't know if I ever would have gotten out of that. And his death, started, I'm still not done, several years of understanding, who he was. I had no idea he was gay and he died of AIDS and he was an AIDS denialist. And, it was quite intense to recognize this over the long haul, and also who I was, that I could, be a patient who, I was only 14 when I met him, so I was a kid. But I was fully enmeshed and believed in him and thought he was God. And so his death freed me. And when my second analyst died, it certainly showed me the ways in which we were stuck. I think her illness also threw a monkey wrench into what had been a pretty good analysis. But once I was a caretaker of ill parents. And so once, these things came in, it became more problematic. I don't know if I would say that about my third analyst, but that might just be because by that time I wasn't willing to be as dependent as I was on my first two. But yeah, no, I think it does beget growth. And, so many, again, contributors to the book, it spurred, it spurred them to become, they were in the field, but it spurred them to become analysts and to do particular kinds of work or to deal with this kind of issue. So it certainly spurred people forward in interesting ways once they could understand what happened.
Oh, it spurred me forward. It really was necessary. You talk about the contributors in the book. So, 10 years prior, you put a thing on Craigslist, you have no takers. When you were at Iptar and you decided again to return to it, you got a lot of takers. What happened when you reached out?
I put a notice on eTalk, just a listserv, and I got quite a few responses right away, and then people, forwarded it to other listservs, and then I heard from more people. At first, there were more people who wanted to do like the memoirs, and then some people just couldn't, they just couldn't do it. I think that, so many years later, it's still hard to write about. It was hard for the contributors, some of them, to write about. Some of them found it really helpful because they finally could kind of make peace with it. One of the contributors wrote her, it wasn't even chapters, just wrote, had 60 pages of, this is the double, 60 pages of writing that she did right after her analyst died and hadn't looked at it since. And that's what turned into her chapters. And mine, it's edited for just punctuation and stuff, but it's what I wrote, right after my second analyst died, before I became an analyst or went into training. So there were a lot of people interested in doing it. And then Nancy Einbinder, she's at Iptar. She right away wanted to write about Iptar. And then, Jerome Blackman, David Bauscher, they both had patients and they wanted to write about their patients and being the second analyst. So yeah, it was enough to put a book together.
Well, it was enough, but also I think, so I said at the top of the interview that when I saw the book was published, I'm like, I want to do this interview. And I was terrified to do it because of how my own experience. And so you did a book launch at Iptar on a Sunday and I'm like, I can't go. I wasn't ready.
How many years later is it? It was 2008 when your analyst died.
Yeah, my analyst died August 1st,
2008. Yeah, it speaks to how hard it is. Like how many years later, and it's still overwhelming, right?
It's still overwhelming. It still comes into my supervision. It's sort of central to my life and central to how I work as an analyst because of the mistake of the over-insulation developmentally. But you said the reception at Iptar was outstanding.
Oh my goodness. I was worried people wouldn't come. There weren't enough seats. It was standing room only. And then so many people afterwards came up to me, and I even got phone calls, you know, with such gratitude for finally speaking about this subject that they weren't able to talk to anybody about. I think that certain analysts must have told their current patients who had been through the experience of losing the analyst about the talk. So patients came who never heard anybody else talk about it. And what struck me the most was, first of all, how emotional they were, of course, but also how grateful they were, because finally something was giving voice to their experience and they could read it and recognize themselves and realize they weren't alone. Like, there's a community of mourners that they didn't know about. So it was quite moving for me, actually, the talk. There was standing room only. People were standing in the back. It was shocking. I was surprised.
Yeah, well, that's what we talked about earlier. It's just the isolation of this very specific loss and how do you do it? And if you're not in the community, you're really, really lost. So this was good. You mentioned, I think it was Nancy's chapter, but others, on being the second analyst after, so a patient comes in having lost their analyst. What was that experience like for them?
I think it depended on the patient and where that patient was in his, her, or their development. So, Merle Malofsky writes about how so much of what she had to grapple with was both her own experience of mourning, how it's something she had a hard time dealing with. She had lost a friend when she was very young, and how she had to come to terms with her own, you know, experience of loss and dealing with it in order to also be there for her patient, Vanessa. They wrote a chapter together.
Right, so she writes with her and Allison.
Yeah. And she also speaks about something that I think probably is very common, how you have to deal with that your patient would wishes that you were the one who was dead, because you're playing second fiddle to an idealized analyst often. And, you know, if you don't feel secure in your technique and in your ability and in your insights, that's probably jarring. You know, I think people probably feel competitive with the first analyst. I don't think anyone says that in the book, though. And then in David Bauscher's chapter, he really writes about how the first analyst was a third person in the analysis because the patient wanted a duplicate and how he was striving to be that duplicate. So he kind of got pulled into that and how he had to free himself from that and be a different person from the dead analyst in order to move forward so that she could give up that because she wasn't able to mourn. But he too, I think both of David Bauscher and Jerome Blackman speak about, you know, a certain competitiveness or being flattered that these people were referred to them because they were referred by colleagues. And so we also see how the second analysts are often know the person who died. So that becomes an issue too, dealing with mourning at the same time as the patient is. I think Merle speaks about that as well. The analyst who died was a good friend of hers. So she and her patient, Vanessa, were in mourning. And so Vanessa was afraid of overwhelming her. So she had to, you know, you have to be aware of your counter transference and your own feelings about the analyst so that you can be there for the patient. And I think you really have to be able to hold just such incredible grief. And one analyst, I think, speaks about how the patient was very angry at the dead analyst and how it was hard for him because the dead analyst was his idealized supervisor. So, you know, something comes up.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about just sort of denial. So I my analyst was married and his wife was an analyst and they shared a suite. So I went right into treatment. Not right. I waited. I wasn't ready. I was not ready, but I went into treatment with her maybe 2 months later. And it was the same couch, the same room. And I'm like, how are we? And she just lost her husband. The long marriage. I don't know how she did it. I don't know how she showed up. But she did. And we worked together and then she died.
Oh my goodness. That must have been so absolutely bizarre for you. How, because she was grieving, you were on the same. I mean, how was that for you? I'm turning the interview around. How was that for you?
It was so what was interesting is that, you know, I go to the office and so I think all in, so their last name was Morel. I talked to a Morel for like 20 plus years. I'd never talked to anybody else, you know, other than supervisors. I stayed in the family, not a family member, which I realized with her. But she, the office that they shared, she couldn't afford the rent on her own. So she had to close it, the physical space, rapidly. And so I think she called me and she says, we're going to meet. And she was then, you know, renting space at our institute, these rooms. So then it became very weird because I was on a couch in rooms where I also practiced, but I was so angry at her for not letting me say goodbye to the space.
Oh, that was a big thing in my world. Go on.
I never got to say goodbye to that office. But that then, as these things do, it really freed our work together. And I had a different analysis. And it was ultimately helpful because I could ask questions about, and this goes to the disclosure piece, I could ask questions about her husband, my analyst, where I could get, in a sense, some pieces of reality out of the transference fantasy. And she was very good. She would feed me reality. And it was so helpful. I am on the side of disclosure. Yes, you take it case by case, but you sent me yesterday an article that Fred Pine wrote about how he dealt with dying, in which his disclosure very recently that he decides to, in a sense, bring his patients along, tell them what's happening. And he says, you know, my first task as I inform patients of the medical reality was to allow patients to leave if they wished without feeling guilt that they were abandoning me. And some took him up on that one, you know, one patient says, listen, I've been through this once before. I'm not doing it again. But then he says, and I really love this, the inverse task also right from the start was to enable patients who chose to stay to feel they could still talk about themselves, almost every one saying that their problems seem trivial next to mine. In all cases, I made it clear that I was continuing because I wanted to do the work that I do and that entailed a focus on their lives. I mean, I think that when I read this and how he did it, that's an ideal of how to handle it, to say, okay, let's do this.
My third analyst did that. And he said, it's a loose quote, but pretty much that he feels it's an honor to do this work and he chooses to do it, which is helpful. You know, I think in my second analysis, my analyst was a self-proclaimed workaholic. So it becomes a little mixed because you also know that the work is, you're being a patient to help them through a hard time. You know, so it gets very murky, you know, and so it becomes a patient might be taking care of an analyst by staying in treatment, by talking about themselves. Like, but I think when my third analyst said that, I knew it to be true. You know, I really knew how much he valued doing his work, and it did free me, but it's never out of, you know, the illness is never out of range. You never stop noticing or thinking about it while, even if you're focusing on yourself. At least I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the head of our institute got very sick very quickly, and she was very open about it. And I told you on our call, I was in a group class where she was teaching the technique of group and running it, but it was both didactic and experiential. And she's wasting away and talking about denial and seeing, and she was brilliant. And she said, what's the denial here? What are people not seeing here? And people like poking around, whatever, and being, as we were, candidates, very, very analytical and theoretical. And she just looked and she says, I'm dying.
Yeah.
And she, that's just how, that's part of character, how she was.
That's helpful.
It was very helpful. It was very helpful. And in fact, the last time I spoke to her, her name was Dr. Meadow. I said, hi, Dr. Meadow. I said, how you doing? She's like, my mind? Terrific. My body's dying. I mean, she was really just right out there. And yeah, that was amazing. But the denial piece, whether it's the denial you don't see it, don't want to know as the analyst or me as the patient, you also, in the book, I was not shocked. I'm like, oh yeah, the pragmatic. You talk about analysts who don't want to let anybody know what's happening because they need to keep working. They need the money coming in. They don't want to lose referrals.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard about that as well. They don't want anybody to, they don't want it to get around the community because then people won't send people to them. They might live for several years. Who knows? They need to work. So it can ruin a business, and a business is what supports them. I mean, I said this to you, and not many people know this, but part of the reason I've never fully become an analyst is I was unconscious. I didn't realize it until very recently that I never wanted to have to support myself through analysis in case I had to stop one day. Like, I never wanted to have to work. I always made my money in a different way. It also allows me to work with, you know, low fee patients, but I think I never wanted to be in that position. And so I never did it because I think that's, you know, that's really, it makes it impossible to put your patients first if you can't afford to tell them the truth. It brings a whole other dynamic into the treatment room. Yeah, which I don't, you know, again, there are realities. And so there's no magic answers how to deal with that.
No, that's a sort of a good place for us to finish here, that through the essays, the memoirs, the stories, and on the one hand, not surprisingly, it's individual, it's case by case basis on how it's handled and where they are developmentally in you, and there's so much that's custom made each time. And yet the wonderful thing where people have the shared metaphor of Mount St. Helens, or when the analysands talk, the shared images, feelings, mine, you know, where I got together with all of my siblings and found out we all had the exact same experience. I know that when an analyst at our institute dies, we have a final group and we'll just come and sit and talk. And it is frequently true when people say share their experience, either as supervisees or in class with a person or as a patient, they say, well, you know, he always said this. And everybody laughs and said, yeah, he said that to us too. And when you find out
that
what you thought was a custom made, you thought it was a custom made intervention for you, you're like, oh no, that was one of his techniques.
It's humbling.
It's very humbling. It's humbling, but now you're like, oh, I have the opportunity to feel understood by somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like when, you know, my mother died this past April and, you know, there's certain things that I can sit with my daughter and say, oh, Omi said that, you know, Omi is called Omi. And to have that for an analyst must be so healing, that, you know, it becomes a real person you can mourn, not just this private, transferential, supposedly only object. It's a real reality loss of a person you love, you know?
Yeah. I have a feeling we could just keep talking about this for the rest of our lives. anything else that I might have missed in the book that you'd like to share before we finish up?
I mean, when I was thinking about the anything else, I was thinking about why, you know, how an analyst, the loss of an analyst is a loss on so many levels, because you lose so many different things. Like, you know, I too wasn't able to say goodbye to the office, which was really hard, because I came to life in that office. All of the different pieces of me took form in that office. And I felt very much like when my analyst died, all of the little me's that came to life in there were like still flying around, and they never got to fly back into me, so that they were part of me. It was a very strange feeling. You know, so many patients lost, you know, all the transferential relationships, the mother, the father, the ghosts of their past. They lost an office, they lost a safe space, they lost a mentor. You know, there's so many things that the analyst is to a patient, that I don't think there's any other relationship in the world, not to say that everyone doesn't play multiple roles, but none quite like an analyst, where there's such a multitude of losses at once. So anyway, that was just because you asked me that when we were chatting the other day, and that's the only thing that came to mind about something that seems just significant to me, that it's such a multitude of losses with one person.
Yeah. It's funny. I have this fantasy that one day I'll rent that office and work there. Mm. It's midtown. It's very expensive. It's too sweet. I don't think I will, but I still want to go back in there sometime.
Yeah. One of the patients in the book got to say goodbye to the office. I was so envious when I read her chapter.
Yes.
It's very envious, but I do hope, you know, I know, you know, through everything we talked about, I really do hope, you know, maybe once COVID isn't, you know, hope for that too, taking precedence in this way, that, you know, communities, analytic communities continue to develop and see the real impact, you know, that their illnesses and deaths have on their patients, and not only the candidates, you know, just patients who have no support, how they can be helped, how we can deal with it in advance, how people aren't just left alone with no one to catch them and hold them. If, you know, if that could happen, it would just be such a wonderful transition, and that it doesn't go underground again, because these things come out, they're talked about when someone dies, and then it goes away. For it to stay in our own consciousness, you know, at workshops or, you know, conferences, anything, you know, so that there can be real lasting change.
Yeah. Well, the book, I mean, I think will help to do that, because it is searchable. And then hopefully this podcast will as well, to keep it front and center. And I will do the work at my institute. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you. I mean, I know part of it is born from your own experience, but I appreciate your interest in it and in the topic, because that's how change will happen. So thank you so much.
That's it. Absolutely. So for our listeners, we've been talking to Claudia Heilbrunn. Her book is What Happens When the Analyst Dies: Unexpected Terminations in Psychoanalysis. Claudia, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.